The backgrounds to what brought me to that specific point in time, that moment in time, was a childhood that was extremely broken, a very, very broken childhood. My father was diagnosed as what was now called bipolar, you know. So for a child, we never had, you know, as his children, we never had a sense of consistency with him. And I was talking about this, funnily enough, with my partner the other day, and she pointed out that really a situation like that for a child sets a kid up for drug addiction or some kind of addiction, because you get the highs and it's all great and daddy's loving, and then he's gone and he's either cold or, and so the kid is constantly trying to get this good thing, you know. So when dad was good, he was great, he'd take us out to the Iron Island youth hostel thing and would cycle and climb mountains, and it was really great. And then he'd be like this completely cold, emotionless person. Both parents died by the time I was 10 years old. Father committed suicide, my mother just literally died. You know, sort of had an emotional, physical, immune system collapse, and, you know, she died right in front of our faces there in the house, you know. That was like, for a 10-year-old kid, and, you know, surrounded by my little brothers and sisters, and, you know, it's not a very healthy thing. A 10-year-old child will suppress this and pack it all away, but it's going to come out eventually. And of course, it started to come out in my late teens, and so on. So you know, the that's kind of, if you like, the pattern that was set, that set me up for the whole Scientology thing. That was it. And within months, I was, within months then of that introduction to Scientology, I was full-time on staff there. I'd sort of cut myself off from my friends and my girlfriend or partner, actually, we were living together. My only circle had become Scientology. And that's partly their effort. In fact, that's very much their effort, actually, to be able to, when they saw someone was like that, someone who was susceptible to Scientology, you know, they'll go for it, they'll grab him. One of the things I observe now is that the staff member in a Scientology organization is kept quite hungry, if you like. They're kept under extreme pressure. They're run on statistics, and each person has to have his statistic. So if you're a body rooter, it's number of people rooted that day, okay? And if you're an evaluator, it's number of people evaluated, or whatever, you know, various statistics that people would have. But the pressure in Scientology to have up statistics is huge. It is just massive pressure. So a body rooter might do five people one day. Well, statistics are done the week, actually, you know. So if in the week that person body rooted 30 people, they'll get a big clap on the back, and that's great. But next week they better have 32. And if the organization is say, trying to win what they call a birthday game, it's one of these games that the Scientology kind of implements. Organization plays against organization in order to become number one in what's called the birthday game. And this is Hubbard's birthday. If it's on the birthday game, then that person has to get what's called an affluent statistic. So a little blip up is called normal. Big shooting up of the statistic, like say you go from 30 to 40, you know, say people body rooting in or something, you know, that's a big blip up on 30, right? 10's a big number, which is grand. But then the week after it, you know, are you going to crash that statistic, or actually you should keep that statistic going up again? So then the week after that, you have to get 42, and So, you know, you can imagine the pressure and the amount of work that has to be done in order to do this thing. And yeah, you can make your cystics drop, but my God, you get in trouble for that in Scientology. It's you know, you get interrogated, you get... I won't go into these ethics conditions now, but you get in trouble for doing that. So they, you know, so when a person like me comes along, I'm kind of easy pickings, and you know, and there's all this pressure cooker of stuff going on. And so this guy says, "Oh, great, there's no problem selling him a book." The course person, I'm going, "No problem getting him on course. Great, I need that statistic." You know, so you get jumped on. You know, you imagine a bunch of crows hopping on a piece of dead meat or something, you know, like that, you know. So I found myself told all these directions in Scientology, join staff, you know, do this course, buy this book, buy these tapes, you know, help out on this project. And all of a sudden, you know, all these things are going on. It's all very new to me. My whole life has been sucked up. 2 months later, I find myself, I'm in the Scientology Center from, oh, I don't know, let's say 9 o'clock in the morning till about maybe 11:30 at night in some cases, yeah. No contact with my friends in my little kind of house I'd rented. There was like another 3 Scientologists living there with me. You know, this kind of thing. So all that stuff is going on. The goal that you get sold a couple of goals of Scientology on the initial level, you're sold the goal of clear, okay? That is, you're educated to the fact that there is what's called a bridge to freedom, which is a series of steps, if you like, up to a higher state. You get educated to the fact that you and the human race is in a bad state, and you get sold on this concept very hard. The initial book that you read, it's called Dianetics. In fact, centers like I walked into are normally called Dianetic centers as opposed to Scientology centers. The reason being to disguise the Scientology end of things, because it never had good public relations. You get sold the idea of what's in Dianetics, and then you almost get the idea that part of your mind is split in 2 parts. There's a sort of conscious level that's seething with evil and pain and horror and strange sexual perversions, and you get this idea, this whole image is kind of really, really laid in on you, and that you have these things called engrams, and an engram is a moment of unconsciousness. Yet what Hubbard is preaching is that this part of the mind, what's called the reactive mind, it never actually goes unconscious. It actually is recording everything all the time, but acting on it in a very simplistic way. So he divides the mind to the reactive and the analytical. And he says the analytical mind, which is the mind, let's say the mind I'm talking with now, if we're using Hubbard's system or Hubbard's framework, that's the analytical mind, and that's the grand, and it's working, it's able to think and everything. But then down below it, there's this subconscious mind. And if in a moment of pain or unconsciousness, my analytical mind shuts off, because it's a more delicate system, then the reactive mind comes into full play and is recording everything that's happening and is supposed to, I don't know, do something to protect the human or the animal or whatever it is, right? But it acts upon things in a very simplistic way. So that, let's try and give an example. If somebody, one of the examples Hubbard uses in Dianetics is, say, the woman who gets, she gets beaten by her husband, knocked unconscious by her husband, right? And then around there's a number of things happening. There's him shouting at her, saying, "You're a stupid, useless, you know, prostitute or a whore or something," right? There's the sound of a tap dripping, there's a car going by, there's the noise of a chair falling, there's the sensation of her head hitting the floor, different things like that. And he says all this stuff's been recorded in full you know, full color and sound and everything. It's all recorded there.